Quick update. I'm launching a new course for 2025. It's Foundations of Application Security. It's a two-day bootcamp covering everything you need to become a well-rounded AppSec practitioner. There's both public and private courses available, and the best part about it all is taught by me. So if you're interested, just send me an email, call@galahcyber.com.au, or say hi on LinkedIn if you can have a chat about it.
Hi, I'm Cole Cornford, and this is Secured, the podcast that dives deep into the world of application security. Today I have a joint podcast where I've got two people coming on, Adam Haskard and Damif Haraf. Adam owns the consultancy Blue Ridge, and Damif is a professor at the University of Canberra. And they wanted to come on and talk to me about an emerging field, which is robotics. Now, we've had robotics in the world for quite a long time. And whenever everyone starts thinking about robotics, they almost always think about manufacturing cars with giant arms and stuff. But we've started to see robotics become more of a consumer and hobbyist industry. And if history is anything to go by, what starts off as something a hobbyist participate in, eventually people start to commercialize and then figure out how do we make money from that. And as soon as they start commercializing things, then they need to start considering the security implications because they can steal money out of that. Adam and Damif have a center of excellence at the University of Canberra, where they're really, really focused on the cybersecurity and physical security outcomes of robotic systems that they call secure robotics. And so this episode's kind of dedicated to recognizing that it's important that even as AppSec professionals, that we need to start looking at domains that aren't just purely web applications for banking and finance. And especially when we consider things like monitoring mines or like healthcare settings and how robots are used to help patients with mobility or to dispense drugs at pharmacies, or even like, I think the most common one we're talking about is the Roombas and robotic vacuum cleaners going around your houses. There are a lot of cybersecurity implications because of the overlap between IT and robotic systems. And so, yeah, this is a call to action. There's a lot of interesting content in there. They're both lovely people and they would love to talk to anyone about robotics. So without further ado, here is Adam and Damif. How are you guys going?
Good, thanks, mate. Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us, Cole.
It's an absolute pleasure. I think that robotics is a super interesting topic. I also am really not educated in it whatsoever. Would you be able to give like a bit of a good explanation just for 101 for my audience? Because a lot of them come from the software engineering and like computer science background. What is robotics and why is it cool?
I might have a crack at it first, Adam, then you can throw in.
Go on.
I'm Damit. So I'm a robotics professor at University of Canberra. I was really passionate about robotics since I was young. There's an inside joke, you know, if somebody asks what a robot is, the right answer is, you know, show me one and I'll tell you whether it's a robot or not. Really varying degrees of definition of what a robot is. For most people, I think a robot is a humanoid. I mean, especially with Elon Musk touting the humanoid form a lot these days, I think we tend to ascribe robotics being humanoid form and doing something that, you know, humans can. Robotics is much broader, obviously. There is a lot of non-humanoid type robots actually been doing the rounds for almost 50, 60 years now. So the common form that, you know, we ascribe robotics is the industrial robot arm, the one that, you know, makes a lot of the cars. And you would have seen the yellow industrial robots that you see in factories. Between that and the humanoid form, there's a few different variants that has, you know, kind of evolved over the time. And one of the first robots that really, I think, reached the, you know, on Mars is the vacuum cleaning robots, the Roomba types. And they're the only really useful robot we still have seen in, you know, in mass production. So we have really done a lot in robotics between the industrial robot arms and the Roomba vacuum cleaning robots. And that's going to change in the next, I think, decade. There's a lot of interesting things happening, especially in the generative AI space that actually allowing robotics to evolve more in the, especially around contextual awareness of, you know, what's happening around a robot. So we're going to see a lot of interesting things happening. And I think it's in that light this conversation is important, because up to now, I mean, I'm a mechanical engineer by training. I never really worried about security in any form. Like, you know, that's one of the last things I think about, because there's so many other things that's going wrong before you can start thinking about security, right? So getting your algorithms right, you know, getting your cameras working and getting the bloody thing to run on the road, you know, like just follow the path. that's already hard stuff. So when somebody tells me like, you need to worry about security, that just, you know, that doesn't compute in any of our minds until now. So the danger now is that we got robots actually entering human spaces much more than we've seen in the last 50, 60 years. Especially the first ones, obviously, more advanced versions of the vacuum cleaning type robots. So these have autonomous navigation, which requires to have, you know, cameras and other sensors to let the robot know what the environment it's working in. So just to give an illustration there, like the first version of the Roomba vacuum cleaning didn't have any cameras, any sophisticated sensors. They just bump sensors at all. That's it. But these were the ones that you have these days. They can do mapping, localization and mapping. And that requires advanced sensors, cameras, depth sensors, and things like that. So that means you got very sophisticated devices now entering into our households with scant regard to security aspects.
And that's like for me, I used to have to vacuum all the time, and I have one of these D-Bot EcoVax things. So just it goes around my house and sometimes whinges to me that it gets trapped, which is my favorite thing because sometimes it just finds its way underneath the table and then locks itself in a position it can't leave. And I'm randomly at a conference or something and I just get a text message saying, D-Bot is trapped, please save D-Bot. And I'm like, I am literally in Canberra. I cannot do this. So I'm sorry, D-Bot, you will remain trapped forever. I love it. It makes my life so much easier. But then even I've been thinking about the considerations of having a robot vacuum cleaner that's connected to a mobile application on my phone. And then also it's connected to my Wi-Fi and it's using infrared or something to map out how my house looks and put it into. So there's a lot of privacy considerations. And I think that's where it's important to bring you into the conversation, Adam. So can you give us a bit of background about yourself and a little bit about what you think we need to be doing for security for robotics as well?
Yeah. I can do that. You automatically, you know, fill some of the things in my imagination that made me leap into this space because it's interesting. And to sort of decorate some of the ideas to myth put forward. So, yeah, my name's Adam Haskard. I have a background in military and IT, cybersecurity, and I run Blue Ridge cybersecurity and technology firm. We're 5 years in. We have lots of customers, lots of clients. But I'm also a researcher in secure robotics at the UC Collaborative Robotics Lab under DeMuth. To me, a robot from an IT perspective or a computer science standpoint is a gaming machine with arms and legs or a gaming machine with wheels. And it reminds me of when I grew up building gaming machines with parts and overclocking CPUs and overclocking RAM and trying to get as much juice out of it as possible. So that's the enthusiasts. And when I see the robotic systems, the state it's in now, that's more or less being driven by the enthusiasts because it's incredibly accessible now than prior to what it was to build robotic systems. And because I saw that kind of landscape in the lab during a course that I was doing at UC, I thought, I wonder what else we can do with it. And I wonder what the vulnerabilities are. I wonder what the threat landscape is. I want to know what these kind of things are as well. And yeah, we had a conversation, many, many, many conversations about these things. And Coles, all of your points, they are all, would be all typical considerations from the cybersecurity lens that literally just have not been applied to the robotic system landscape. And that's because just like back in the day, we wanted to get those IT systems and server client systems to work. We didn't really need them to be secure. We just needed them to work.
I think that one of the funniest things that pops up when I just opened my D-Bot app right then, and on the very front page, it just says, we are ISO certified. So there you go. Look, they're good on them.
Yeah, well.
But there's tremendous scope for things that can go wrong because I guess it's when we work with IT systems like and just software. If you make a mistake, there's a good chance that you can immediately fix the mistake. But yeah. I think that's tremendously more difficult when you're dealing with like physical machines and manufacturing because the cost to fix those problems, you have to recall a lot of the time. Like, yeah, we can put over the air to change the firmware or stuff, but then your supply chain tax. I think there's like so many different ways that we're just like completely inconsiderate of nowadays. So like what types of cybersecurity threats do you think are the most important for us to be even looking at to even start with? Because it could be everything from like, how do we manage the supply chain of the parts that we bring in to build robotics or to the software that we produce, or even just like the privacy of the data that would, you know, cameras of my living room.
You see how your brain's exploding with the possibilities and all of the knock-on effects? Like, this is definitely the invitation that Dimith and I bring today to the cybersecurity cohort, is to get involved in robotics, because it is multidisciplinary and they do need us. But to your point there, like, what are some of the threats? Well, it might just be useful if I quickly just map out how we see secure robotics and we can just jump off that as a leap-off point. So when I very first went in, I'd wrapped up some study and I said, Dimith, this is what I want to do. I want to develop some application security controls in robotic systems. I want to test these controls, and then I want to make it so that these technical controls make a direct contribution to the engineering and the safety of these systems. And Dimith was like, yeah, but you can do that. It's straightforward, but we really need to consider trust. We nearly need to consider how cybersecurity affects trust and the knock-on effect for cybersecurity and safety. And I'm paraphrasing lots of discussions that we had. So what we did was we just rifled through literature for 2 or 3 years to find, and we found that what emerged at that intersection of cybersecurity, human-to-robot trust, and safety is that paradigm of secure robotics. And that is the reason, one of the reasons, Cole, that is because there is a safety knock-on effect, whereby if there's a vulnerability or exposure that gets from an IT system, it's usually that'll involve maybe the system will get turned off, let's say, but it's probably going to be a data issue, like an exfil or some kind of situation. Whereas, you know, with the robotic system, because they're cyber-physical systems, they have a real knock-on effect and they can interact with the real world. And people, and that wouldn't be excellent. It could be good, but it could also be bad.
And also, if I could, Adam, if I just could just put a little example to this. So a few years ago, some folks in China managed to hack a Tesla or self-driving car by putting some stickers on the road. So that in itself is a, you know, security threat of a different kind. So, you know, situations like that haven't been really, you know, computed in designing, you know, autonomous systems. So these are other examples of, you know, where security, trust, and safety comes into play. So the paradigm is actually a bit broader than just cybersecurity. So I think that's kind of one thing that I think we should keep in mind when discussing these kinds of cyber-physical systems.
There's been a lot of situations with self-driving cars, like over in the States, where people have just been mucking around trying to influence the behavior, basically pen testing them, but they really shouldn't because they don't have permission. I think my favorite one was taxi drivers who were frustrated with Waymo taking a lot of just their work away from them by providing free tests to drive between places. They would just like throw traffic cones onto the cars. And then the cars just had no idea how to respond because they see a traffic cone, but it just doesn't move no matter how they move, because it's on the vehicle. And then they're like, well, I guess I just got to stop. And then the passenger's annoyed because the car's not going anywhere and the vehicle's just being safe because it knows, well, I'm in a construction zone always at all points. Therefore,
for the cybersecurity cohort listening, like the offensive guys, that's more or less a denial of service attack using a traffic cone to one of its interfaces. And like, it seems novel and it's like, wow, that's crazy. But that's, like, when I grew up, it was like, oh, I'm just going to send all these malformed packets to this interface and crash my school server's website because I have an exam coming up. And this is more or less the same thing. It's like, we can't drive the exam now, but you can't drive that car. And one of the things is, there's robotic systems, as Dimith alluded to earlier, comparing early Roombas to now, they're always adding new, there's always going to be new sensors, not less, new interfaces to get information. And because there is always going to be new streams of information that is being fed into that robotic system or the cyber physical system, augmenting what it can and can't do, all of those interfaces are critical into being secure. Not to mention, as you were speaking about your own vacuum cleaner earlier, that has an interface into the internet onto your app as well. You know what I mean? Like, that's like, there's an interface from that robotic system right from your house into your app. It's an interesting proposition for a lot of folks listening, I'm sure.
Well, I think everybody should like go out and have a little bit of a play and have a think about what they can do in this space. But I wanted to move back towards safety and engineering, a little bit away from cybersecurity. So you were saying that there, because I'm considerate of what I typically have seen robots in media being used for. So things like we have warehouses and we need to be able to move, everyone knows the fleet of Amazon drones that move all the different pieces together. Or it's the arms, like I went to Hiroshima to the Mazda factory like a long time ago before the pandemic. I thought that was really cool, being able to watch how the vehicles were being created using these arms. But if I could think about like the future of manufacturing, you want to be in a situation where you don't just have like physically static plants and production lines, right? You want to have robots that could potentially change the tasks that they do in response to changing demand. So like how do we go about making these systems like safe? Because like cyber is a lot of time focused on the protection of data and information, but not necessarily on safety.
So a few years back, this is again a news, bit of big news at Volkswagen factory, I think in Germany, where one of the engineers entered the robot space and he didn't follow the protocols and the robot got activated and he was killed. And, you know, that was really devastating. And that's in a very secure system, right? Like there's protocols and he was just not following the protocols per se. What has happened from then and now is that, you know, we got, you know, intuitive systems actually that we are in the generation, what we call collaborative robots. So these are, or cobots, these are robots designed for working in human spaces, so they are much more relatively safe. But as you said, Cole, now, you know, to make these robots work, they actually need to be connected to the internet all the time. They rely on additional data. So the old school factories, they didn't really rely on a lot of data. They just have very simple sensors, stop start sequences and things like that. A lot of it is programmed, pre-programmed, so you didn't have any kind of leeway to inject in new information. As it is possible in these days in modern robotics. So modern ones are much more, you know, evolving. A lot of the interaction happens through the interactions with people. So they're not pre-programmed per se. So there's a lot of opportunities to then interject, you know, additional, you know, protocols and things like that. So it's more like the live internet than like a physical, you know, pre-programmed entity back in the day. Unlike the Volkswagen scenario, the robots are much more loose now. Like they are not in really secure environments. You've got the Roomba vacuum cleaners, obviously. Like if somebody has control of one of these things, they can easily map your environment, right? Like you can actually literally get a map. So if one of these robots in a secure facility, like, you know, in a defense facility or something, somebody can literally map the entire facility using one of these vacuum cleaners and nobody will notice it. Right. So these are some of the emerging risks in that space. So how do you kind of go about solving this problem? One of the difficulties right now is that, you know, as these robots get sophisticated, so are their algorithms. Like, you know, even this vacuum cleaning robot that you have right now, like the D-Bot ones, they have a number of different software systems, like, you know, talking to each other at different, you know, application levels. There could be, you know, one point in this chain of, you know, interaction that is not as secure as any other point. And that could be the place that, you know, somebody can inject. How do you maintain these kinds of complex systems to be fully secure? I think these are some of the kind of emerging problems that we are seeing now. And that's kind of what I think Adam's
piece. Yeah, so no, that's right. And I think this is what I think, Cole, like this is early, it's relatively early days in this field, hence why this is like, but this discussion today is definitely an invitation to the cybersecurity community to take part in robotics. What's something that I lean towards that I'm sure a lot of the audience would be familiar with is security controls being implemented, let's say in whether administrative controls, training controls, physical controls, technical controls, probably from some control framework. And the control frameworks that a lot of us are familiar with will usually be around data classification. They'll be like, you know, like these controls are must for a TS or if it's the JSIG or something like that, they'll be like, if it's a special access program, you have to have these controls. And there'll be a bunch of more or less prescriptive security rule sets that you need to implement across those different domains. What I think with robotics is likely to occur, at least at this early stage, just looking around the corner a little bit, is that some of the security controls will have direct trust and safety implications. And I think that if you, by implementing some of the controls within the secure robotics paradigm, that you would have improved, you will have a turnaround and improvement in trust and safety, just like we would for securing systems in the traditional IT sense, where it's like, you know, we're gonna improve its like the data holding, we're gonna improve its network security, so then now it can be a secret system, for example. And I think that probably there will be watermarks for trust and safety depending on the operational context of those systems that security practitioners will need to meet.
Do you think that we're going to go down, at least domestically in Australia, any pathway? Because I know that IoT, which oftentimes can be somewhat related to robotics, because a lot of the time you get a vacuum cleaner that just has a Raspberry Pi on it. Maybe that's like a very sophisticated, like a home, a very homebrew variety of a Roomba. Maybe probably 10 times as expensive, but whatever. Let people have fun with the hobbyist activities. Do you think we're going to go down a route where we're going to have to regulate the security of these devices? And like, I guess another thing that I'd be interested in learning more about is like, I think that a lot of the assumptions that we make in cybersecurity is that we're going to just focus on the protection of the data and like just cut people's access. And like, I think that the traditional approach of just like saying no and stopping is actually really bad when you consider that safety and reliability are like more important in the physical environment than in the internet space. And so if you've got a robot arm that, I don't know, maybe it helps lift up people in hospital beds or something as well, and then it gets hacked, do you want it to like shut down completely and then have someone who's potentially incapacitated? Like,
yeah, no, this is important to me because when I was in, I was in Japan recently at ICRA, and a lot of the effort that was an exceptional event, and a lot of the effort that the robotics engineering and roboticists, robotics teams are putting into an investment is in healthcare, to that example, and elder care as well, and using robot systems to augment the existing labor force. I think that's a noble thing, and I think that's useful. What I wouldn't want, what I wouldn't recommend is, that shutdown, like this situation's been, you know, like if there's an issue, then it gets shut down. But this is the thing is that the gravity of things going wrong in robots because of the trust and safety elements might be more jarring than an IoT system that gets hacked. But this is what I think about that on the regulations. What I think is that the robotic systems that have that are the most useful and that are the most secure, and I have an analogy, which I'll mention, will get the most uptake. And what our lab believes and what the literature points to is that trust is really the foundation of human to robot interaction, and cybersecurity is an ingredient to that trust. And yeah, like it takes a long time of successful use to build trust. And the analogy I'll just quickly mention there is like with online banking. When we grew up, we didn't do that. There's lots of things you didn't do on the internet. You certainly didn't get some stranger's car and get in their car. That wasn't a thing. In fact, I'm pretty sure when you grew up, there was a thing called Net Nanny, and it would tell you where you could or couldn't go, and you would definitely not be putting your mum's credit card in. And that what allowed that to happen was cybersecurity implementations into the interaction increased trust over time to the point now where people are putting their license up and it's no problem. But what didn't happen was that we didn't see like the internet get cancelled because there was early hacks. It just got improved. So my hope is that cybersecurity practitioners can contribute security implementations, because I do believe that that robotic systems contributions to the economy, to the global economy, is immense. It has the real possibility to be immense.
So, Dami, what areas of the economy do you think, like, where do you see the growth in robotics? I go to hospitals reasonable about at the moment because I'm getting ready to prepare for a knee replacement. And so I get to see different things like, beds being pushed up and down, or like the different types of Siemens equipment for like, you know, just facilitating and helping allied health. But like, where else do you see is like growth opportunities in the sector? Because obviously people in hospitals tend to be the folk who are most at risk if there is a safety issue, because they're frail or they have like some kind of illness or they're otherwise incapacitated. And we obviously want to be in a scenario where we're protecting those individuals as a priority, but there's got to be a lot of other places, like maybe in mining or like in telecommunications or banking. Where else do you see the opportunities?
There's plenty of opportunities in different disciplines and different industries. Just a point to the previous question, Cole, if I could add.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think it's really important that we get the regulation bit right, because you don't want to stifle innovation, especially in Australia is not really leading that pack. And if you put, you know, heavy-handed sort of guardrails onto it, I think that'll stifle innovation. So it has to be very, you know, balanced. And I saw just the Albanese government put out a new program around AI guardrails, and they're looking at high-risk events being, you know, controlled first as an approach. I think that's a relatively, you know, better approach. So you look at what are the high-risk situations that AI could be problematic, and then put guardrails onto those ones and so on and so forth. So that's quite important, I think. You know, we get the balance right. It's like, I think there are better opportunities with AI to improve the human condition than without it. So I think we want to make sure that that's taken, you know, consideration when you're putting our guardrails on. To the point about, you know, opportunities in robotics, as I said, with this new generative AI paradigm that's emerging, there's a lot more possibilities for robotics. So one of the difficulties with robotics was that they are physical systems interacting with physical world, and humans are really adept at understanding this physical world without us, you know, being trained a lot. Like, and if you think about a little, you know, child, they learn to walk and talk in a very small amount of time with little information, right? Like they, you know, they would see a couple of things, and then they can extrapolate from that to other, you know, information and things like that. So humans are really adapted. And thing called Moravec's paradox in robotics, which basically means that anything that's easier for humans, it's really hard for robots, and vice versa. So anything that we find repetitive and, you know, boring, these things can be easily automated, and everything else is really hard. And that hardness comes from not being able to understand, perceive the world in the way the humans kind of do. So that's kind of changing a little with AI. So this allows the Moravec paradox to be kind of changed a bit, because now I think a lot of robotic systems have perception abilities that you know, reasonably come closer to human. Like computer vision, for example, it's now exceeding human level comprehension in visual tasks. So actually machines are better at understanding images now. So this will evolve over the next, you know, 5 to 10 years, obviously. And that allows robots to be integrated in a lot of other places. So health is an obvious one industry, healthcare, aged care. And then mining has already been automated to some extent. Like we've done a lot of work in Australia, actually, to automate mining systems.
Agriculture as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And this can expand into all the other human industries that requires, you know, a fair bit of human labor. We would say, you know, the robots can replace a lot of the dull and dirty jobs that human has to do. Just an example, like in our lab, we do a lot of research with recycling. So waste recycling, whether it's in organic waste or textile, we're actually working on a lot of different types of robots. One of the disgusting thing that's actually right now happening with one of our industry partners, they are recycling organic waste. So a lot of food waste that's from, you know, Woolies and other places like that come to their facility to be sorted and, you know, identify all the contaminants like, you know, metal and plastics and things like that. And that's done by human. I mean, that's a really disgusting job. If you can imagine like rotten meat and all that coming in, and you need to put your hands to sift through it.
Have you had to take an internship there as well? Like, it's good to get a sabbatical sometimes, right? So just, you know, just have a good sniff.
Absolutely. Like, even if you just go near the facility and come back, you smell really bad. So these things, it could be benefit from robotics. But the problem is so complex, it requires a lot more work to be done. But I think that's kind of where robotics is heading. So a lot of these really, you know, dirty and dull problems will be solved in the next 10 years.
Yeah. Like, Cole, on that point there, let's say robotics in the wild and systems in the wild. And I think one of the elements that makes it really possible that you're about to see an explosion of this is, because I alluded to it earlier, is the enthusiast. So because of AI assisting builders and makers, and because of embodied AI into robotic systems, the robotic systems become much more sophisticated, but that sophistication is accessible because you can enthusiasts can buy components and parts that can use robot operating system you know, one or two, and there's plenty of information. And all of a sudden, they have manufactured a robot that does a particular function. And it might be something small, like a proof of concept, but that proof of concept with a little more development can be picking apples on an apple farm, like shortly. And it's just something that they made in their backyard, which I keep alluding to, like IT in the 90s, because that was the same for us, where it's like, no, my dad put Counter-Strike on a server that he got from work. And now we have a local thing and everyone comes around. And it was like real novel at the time. And you have these LAN parties and then people are building all these computers, LAN, and gaming was driving that. But I think in this instance, something that will drive it is the fact that building robotic systems is now way more accessible with AI assistance and the data that's out there. I think, I definitely see like a large uptake.
And that's like mostly because of the computer vision? Is that like the really, really big change? Yeah, I could see that as well.
Yeah, you can buy parts you can buy like a base robot system. Let's say it's a Turtlebot. And you can buy all sorts of, it's fully designed to be modular, to plug in arms, legs, computer vision, microphones. And then you just go right ahead and get an app and you just connect it up and you get the nodes talking. And then you're like, wow, my Turtlebot can like sing and it can, and it's embodied AI as well. So yeah, like it's got ChatGPT in it and all of a sudden your Turtlebot's doing all sorts of crazy things. And then what's super unique about that is that there's hundreds and thousands of makers coming online doing this all the time because it's so much more accessible. So I think the enthusiasts will be driving a lot of this.
Yeah, and to the point that Adam's making, the other thing that actually made robotics to really flourish in the last decade is open source software.
Yeah.
So robot operating system is the kind of the common glue between a lot of the algorithms and architectures and all the other kind of enabling drivers and software packages. So back in the day when I was doing my PhD, every lab is for themselves. Like they'll be, really secretly writing their own drivers and software pieces. So it's really kind of reinventing the wheel every time somebody has to do some work. But then robotic operating system came about in the late 2000s. That really, really allowed everybody to share code. A lot of the success in robotics is due to open source movement.
So does that sound familiar, Cole? Like the open source movement driving certain things?
I last night, you'll probably have a laugh, but I was recording another podcast episode with the CTO of Sonatype and Ilka. And Sonatype are a software security, like open source supply chain software security business. That's all I do. And we spent a tremendous amount of time talking about how in the early 2000s, Maven was the Java ecosystem that was able to push out and start getting people to consider, how do we manage software supply chain risk? How do we stop people vendoring and pulling stuff in? How do we get people to start patching components? How do we trust? How do we? And I'm just like, oh, it's such a deep rabbit hole of things that we need to be managing. And now we've got to do it for robotics too.
Robots.
Like robots, too much.
that open source element has just really supercharged it. And, which is a good thing. Like, well, I see it as an excellent. I think there's tremendous opportunity for people to take on, like, people with an IT background or a cyber background to just think of. For me, I just think about it as a gaming machine. I'm like, I'm going to build this thing.
It's been a while since I've been able to build a machine. I think the last time I built one would have been like 2010. I was just dating myself, I guess, because I used to play heaps of Team Fortress 2 competitively, and so that was like my like cup of tea. I actually know a lot of people who work in the APS or like in cybersecurity who recognize me from TF2. So I guess, like, I don't know, everybody ends up like in cybersecurity after playing Team Fortress 2. So
I'll tell you, Cole, what I think, if I could, for the audience, that I know a lot of your audience will be familiar with like a SOC environment and, you know, security operation centers where you're triaging logs from apps, from various data points, and there's incident response. This is where I think just around the corner we'll see when there's a fleet of robot systems in an agriculture setting or a mining setting, and they're basically assisting the economy. I think there is an opportunity for a human on the loop for traditional cybersecurity SOC models to be bolted onto the top of those robot systems to do like how SOC analysts would traditionally monitor those events and incident response, but also probably likely have some kind of integration with the fail-safe and engineering mechanisms, because they're going to be seeing engineering logs as well. and then triage that from an incident response standpoint.
All I can think about is like having an apple orchard, and then there's just like 20 machines running around with their 70 arms collecting apples, and then 10 drones flying above them using computer vision, looking at them like a prison yard, staring at all of these robots being like, are you doing anything dodgy, right? So, and I agree. Like every single one of these devices can produce telemetry across so many different sensors. And then we need to be, the way that we're traditionally dealing, I guess, with devices, the telemetry is going to be significantly higher throughput. Like, because like if I think about MQTT and like there's just, you know, managing streams of data rather than like requests and responses, which is what I imagine most SOCs are traditionally used to, is like a computer makes a call or makes a bunch of calls and we look at logs. That's kind of hard when you're looking at thousands of logs per second because of the temperature of something.
Well, also, Cole, to that as well, like it's true. Like normally from in a SOC environment, you'll see, the call from one app to another app or a call from one interface to another interface across a network or multiple networks. And then you're just bouncing around to see where was the source and where was the origin and where did it end up. The thing with robotic systems, it makes calls to itself. So it's got nodes, and in those nodes, it's like a little network where it makes calls to itself. So this is where I see it's like there's a real possible evolution for cybersecurity SOC analysts to be able to monitor that, because that, to tie into our actual first point, that human on the loop most certainly does in that format, which we see with the SOC, with banking, would increase trust and use. And it's also that jobs point too. Like I don't believe that robots are going to be taking people's jobs, because it's going to be creating new supply chains and new jobs in order for the trust and safety to do those jobs.
It's either that or like people start paying to go pick apples as like a family outing.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I don't want to give you a job. This is actually a retreat.
Yeah, like it's like homesteading. Like people buy houses and homestead them with hobby farms now. And like that used to be like, that was the daily grind, but now that's like a hobby. Like I can't believe there isn't a hobby farm is even a thing.
So like I see like a lot of heuristic analysis as kind of being a way to be detecting if there's issues with either individual robots or the behavior of those robots. And then we can bring that into a security operations center. Like that's the way to, like, I think, a different paradigm shift for how traditional like security operations works. Let's think about maybe governance, risk, and compliance. Like, what are we going to be doing to just like help the GRC professionals prepare for a, you know, secure robotics environment world? So,
yeah, well, what I think about that is, we submitted a paper to a journal. It's a tail end of peer reviews, but it's based more or less a wide range of literature review across the three domains. But in that, we proposed a composite security measurement model. And that composite security measurement model is an aggregation of the different domains that a GRC professional would look at within the operational context to achieve what we describe as an R value. So what all that Swahili means for a GRC professional is that we think that likely you would be able to achieve a security level of a robot system in a particular operational context, which is not too different to how GRC experts will work now with risk. You know what I mean? Like, say it's a disconnected system. You've got a disconnected IT system, but it's got no security controls, but it's disconnected. So like there would be in that risk management component, it's like, well, maybe we don't need that much. Unless you're Stuxnet, and I get it. I'm just saying, you know what I'm saying?
So the operational context matters a lot for these robots, right? So like obviously a vacuum cleaner that is traveling around a data center that's IRAP assessed is probably that's hosting T4 data is probably going to have a lot more scrutiny than my vacuum cleaner.
Yes, it would need to achieve a much higher R value for that. In the algorithm we proposed, it's there's a priority. So like for healthcare robots, safety of patients. So safety is the number one thing for those robots. So that means the security controls that get implemented would have to contribute to safety to achieve that R value that's been prioritized. So for GRC professionals, we see secure robotics as a new paradigm, but it would be with greater level of difficulty, but with more resources. I think you're going to be more resourced to be able to triage these things. And yeah, I think you can kind of see that the bridge that we're creating here.
That's it, guys. You got to get into robotics. So speaking of that, I think it's time to shift gears a little bit to some of the faster questions. So, I mean, if I've got one for you, that's just pretty straightforward. Someone wants to get into robotics. Where do they start? What would you recommend?
You need to have good passion, I think, because it requires some tenacity because you're dealing with hardware. And what I see with a lot of students coming in, they're really excited about the proposition of robotics. But then they don't really put the hard yards to actually really get into it and really get your hands dirty, you know, build your circuits, you know, build your do your programming, because it's multidisciplinary, right? So you got to do not just programming, but you also have to play with your hardware. So enthusiasm and grit is number one. Like, you want to really persist and push through because there are going to be a lot of failings down the track, and you want to kind of strive through them. So that's kind of at a base level. Like, you need to really have that passion inside of you to kind of really be inquisitive and exploratory. And then I think boring one is you need to have a bit of maths. Unfortunately, you got to have some reasonable amount of interest in maths and to kind of really, if you want to get into it. And then the ability to think logically is quite important. So programming skills comes from that. So really my intention is just tinker with, you know, hardware, like get some Arduinos, put some motors together and control and see if you are really interested in that and getting that work happening. So that's kind of the basic level, I guess, entry requirements. And then, you know, if you want to really pursue that, obviously a bachelor's level degree is a good place to start, of which we just launched a new intelligent robotics program at University of Canberra. It's a 4-year honors program. And I'm really proud of that. I think it's one of the coolest programs because it's really interdisciplinary. So you got to also be careful about which university you select to do your robotics degree because we have different flavors of it. So if you're more interested in software side of it, you know, some of the degrees that are offered by faculty working in software side of things is important. But if you're more hands-on type person who actually want to work with the hardware, then you want to find a degree that actually alludes to that. So mechatronics and hardware robotics is a good place to start. So our one is actually in the middle. So we are bringing a lot of the AI and software part as well as the hardcore engineering, mechanical engineering into it. So if you're in Canberra and the surrounds, we actually got the open day happening as well. So,
and not long, you'll have a new vice chancellor, I hear. So,
absolutely. We are interested, excited.
Can I add one thing to that question you asked him, Ms. Cole? Is that all right, real quick?
Yeah, absolutely.
I think for all the people with IT backgrounds listening, I think that everything Demith said is true. I think that for all the people who have an IT background, they're very well positioned into, because they're used to grinding their head in the glass trying to get stuff to work. That's like what IT people do. That's what I do, and it's what Cole's done. Whether it's applications or serves, it's just how it is. If they were interested, I would encourage them to buy any robot that's based on ROS, and then get it to do stuff, and then keep bolting more stuff on it and get it to do stuff, just like you did with your gaming PC back in the day. That's what I would say. And then use all the resources online that you normally would when you're grinding your face in the glass to get stuff work, and you're gonna have a good time.
It's funny because obviously my background is like super heavily software engineering. Like, obviously application security is, you just have to learn how to build applications. And for me, it's like everything about like environment parity, build reproducibility, scale, all that stuff, as well as like maintenance code, like hire the right resources, using the right technologies, all that jazz. You only get to worry about that kind of stuff after you get past what I call the cliff. Because when you go to study programming for the first time, everybody encounters the cliff. And then at some point they're like, oh, I finally understand like how to decompose a problem and then turn it into a series of steps like that a computer would understand. And I think it's exactly the same in robotics by the sounds of it.
And I think if you've got a software background or a hardware background, a mechanical engineering background, an IT background, with IT is just really just integration, that you've got a perfectly good jump off point to dive right in. I believe that.
Yeah, the only thing I can add to that is it's actually quite multidisciplinary. So you need to have a really open mind about working with other folks in the other side of it. Like, a lot of, especially with a lot of IT grads, they're really reluctant to get their hands dirty on the hardware side. And so like, I don't want to touch it. And then they kind of veer off. I mean, we lose a lot of good programmers because of that, you know, their fear of really integrating with the hardware side. So really got to have an open mind and really talk to each other. Like, you know, it's funny. People don't really, I think, appreciate this outside of the domains, like, you know, how different we are, the mechanical engineers and the computer scientists. but we need both of them to really make things happen in robotics. Like, it's a software plus hardware. So anybody who's interested in, I think, one or the other side of the kind of spectrum, I think you've got to be a bit more open-minded. Like, I want to talk to software guys, or I want to talk to the engineers as well. Like, so that's how we get robots built.
So if you're interested in secure robotics, why not go have a look at either Blue Ridge Consulting? You can go work with Adam a bit and just get into this new interesting niche field, or go to the University of Canberra, like taking new students now.
Carl, I'm pretty confident that in the future, I think we'll be having discussions on this. And I think that a lot of the security firms, including your own, will be doing work on these things. And we might even see a period where the ANCAP rating includes a cybersecurity component.
And for those who don't know, that's safety.
You are. Yeah.
Well, Adam and Damith, thank you so much for coming on to Secured. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Thank you. Thank you. Appreciate it.
Thanks a lot for listening to this episode of Secured. If you've got any feedback at all, feel free to hit us up and let us know. If you'd like to learn more about how Galah Cyber can help keep your business secured, go to galahcyber.com.au.
If you're new to the show or a seasoned veteran, I want to hear from you. I'm always looking to do better as a podcast host and as a person. So tell me about what I can do better. Tell me about the types of people you want on my podcast. Tell me about if the format's working for you or styles need to be switched up. Do I need to interview differently? So on and so forth. I appreciate you sticking with me for almost 30 episodes at this stage, and I hope I can keep learning and you can keep learning and being entertained for many more episodes to come. So please shoot me feedback. I want the good, the bad, and the ugly to pod@galahcyber.com.au. And if you don't like email, hit me up on LinkedIn.